Hello and welcome to the Environment and Conservation Show on UK Health Radio. I'm your host Yasmin, and today we will be exploring the world of mycelium with Yasmin Ostendorf, founder of Future Materials Bank, Green Art Alliance, and is currently writing a book on mycelium as methodology. Yasmin's work underpins the way in which we can use mycelium as a method in order to understand not only how we can interact with each other, but also the environment in a way that is more sustainable, particularly around the work of artists and activists who collaborate. And for example, the work of the Future Materials Bank is a way for artists to collaborate on creating more sustainable and natural art materials. So it's about moving forward in a way that uses mycelium as a kind of structure. And I will go on to explain more about mycelium, but essentially it's the roots of a fungi and the network known as the wood wide web, which interacts with plants, well, helps plants interact under the soil by helping them communicate. But there will be more chance for you to listen more deeply about what mycelium is at the end of this podcast. So thank you for joining us today, and I hope you enjoy. So hi, Yasmin, and welcome to the Environment and Conservation Show.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today. It's nice to have another Yasmin on the show.
Yeah.
And I know you're doing loads of interesting stuff out in Brazil at the moment. So
yeah,
just tell us about where you're coming in from and what you're doing.
So at the moment, I'm in the state of Minas Gerais, which is a big state in Brazil. And the closest village would be Gonçalves. And then from there, it's still like, I don't know, half an hour, 45-minute drive to the actual farm. And this is a small community running this farm. And it's a biodynamic shiitake farm. There's chickens, and then there's bees and agroforestry. Agrofloresta, as we call it here. And there is a lot of araucaria trees here, which is amazing, like the pine trees. So we've had a season also of harvesting the pinhões, the pinhão, which is a seed of the araucaria tree. So that's also been like a big kind of part of what I've been spending my time on, is just picking pinhões, picking seeds.
So what's the seed?
What's the seed?
Yeah, what's it used for?
Oh, loads of things. It's so versatile. It's incredible. I mean, you boil it and you can have it just as a snack with a little bit of olive oil and salt, but you can make a flour out of it and make a bread. You can, if you kind of grind it, it's also quite nutty, so you could have it as a, yeah, like an alternative type of nut over your pasta or whatever. It's incredible. It's so versatile. So.
And why you'd spend so much time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I believe you're doing work as well with mycelium and shiitake growing.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I moved to the farm because I kind of became what we call a mycophile, so someone who's slightly obsessed with mushrooms. And I thought it would be interesting to actually, you know, spend time with the mushroom every day in order to, I don't know, become mushroom, or like start thinking like a mushroom or smelling the mushroom. I mean, it's also to do with the senses, of course, you know, this kind of awakening the senses. And so yeah, part of the day is the actual harvesting of the shiitake, which we do in the morning. And then I also, yeah, spend time writing my book, which is called Mycelium as Methodology, in which I look more into there's a biomimicry of the mycelium. So
what do you mean by biomimicry?
Biomimicry is like the practice of looking at natural things or processes in order to build our society. So like it could be a lot of biomimicry is object based. So that would be looking at the bird, looking at the wings of a bird, for instance, to design an airplane. But my approach is more looking at system design. So in this case, the actual network of the fungus and how it organizes itself and how it behaves and exchanges resources and how different species are mutually beneficial based on this kind of transport network of the mycelium. And then how we can, from that, develop a blueprint for just ways of collaboration, but also organizing networks, organizing food distribution, organizing activists, like how activist movements could organize themselves, like uniting battles. Yeah, there's a lot of lessons in the mycelium, I find.
And what is it about mycelium that gives it so many lessons?
Because it keeps on, it's never static. Like, flexibility is like at the core of it. So it could also be that in certain areas it remains dormant and then suddenly it kind of wakes up because there is a need. So it's very much based on where there is a need of an excess of resources, or where there is electric signaling saying, okay, there is something going on in this context. So it's very flexible. It always moves depending on what's necessary. And that makes it, I think, extra interesting kind of in the context of the pandemic, because actually the fungus, like broader than just the mycelium, the fungus crises are opportunities for fungi, because it means there is increased symbiosis, and they change themselves in order to survive. So like an interesting example is after a Fukushima disaster in Japan, like the first thing that grew back after this disaster was a Matsutake mushroom, which is the beginning of a book called Mushroom at the End of the World on Life in Capitalist Ruins by Anand Singh. And that's just like one example of how fungi can actually thrive in very precarious situations, because it means, you know, there's a increased need to connect and to exchange and to be flexible. And I think looking at where we are in the world, climate change and pandemics, and there's a lot that we can learn from that way of working and realizing how everything is entangled.
Completely. And I was just thinking about the Fukushima thing, because Paul Statnitz, who is obviously a massive micro-remediology, when they come to
micro-remediation,
yeah. That's the word. Yeah. And he was talking about using mushrooms there to kind of absorb and take out a lot of the excess stuff that was left behind from the disaster. And
that's a
fascinating way that they can.
It's incredible. I mean, whether that's radiation, whether that's oil spills. I mean, there's even, you know, types of fungi that feed on cigarette butts if you train them in a certain way. So it's really just kind of mind-boggling how many possible solutions for our society are also just based on fungal behavior.
Absolutely. It's so fascinating as well, because I've been reading Entangled Lives.
Yeah, and incredible. I love that book.
Incredible. And I'm learning so much about this world that exists right beneath our feet. And we don't, we know, he says like a lot, we know more about what's in space than the actual fungus beneath the soil and our feet. That's almost quite alien-like in the way that it's so intelligent, and it doesn't have a central nervous system, or it's never been classified as an intelligent being, but it operates. It's so fascinating. Like, they've showed how mycelium can map city routes, like
infrastructure. Exactly. Yeah, that's the slime mold. Yeah,
and the slime molds. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
I mean, I don't know if they classify as fungus, but
it's within the fungal kingdom. You know, you have yeasts, you have slime molds. There's so many different types. Yeah. And that's also just really interesting to see that diversity. And there's, you know, I think there's only less than 5% of the diversity in mushrooms that we have identified as such. You know, so there is still also so much out there. And I think, I mean, more and more people are seeing that and realizing that, and you're you know, seeing so many, there's a whole shroom boom happening. Same. So a lot of people are also artists, designers working with mycelium as a building block, you know, as a material for sculpture or whatever, and as a health supplement, medical treatment, micro-remediation, experiments with psilocybin in mental health trials. Like, it's really with the technology that we have now, a lot of things we have access to, much more knowledge and understanding around the fungus. So this whole new world is opening. Well, it's not a new world, it's always been there, but now we also, with certain technologies, we can actually see it or recognize it.
And maybe it's only now that it's becoming recognized by science.
Totally. Yeah,
is making it a lot more popular and you hearing about it more, because fungi has never been seen as something that's quite like in. Suddenly it's popping up everywhere, which is a really amazing thing, because we're only kind of starting to learn about how many ways it can be used. And I've seen that you've been working with a project called the Future Materials Bank, which is doing just that. Partly,
that's a project that I set up about 1 year ago now, while I was still working for the Jan van Eyck Academy in the Netherlands, which is a postgraduate residency program for artists. And they are partner also in this bigger network that I run called the Green Art Lab Alliance. And one thing that we found is that actually there is a lot of interest from artists and designers to engage with environmental issues, you know, climate justice and whatnot, the notion of the Anthropocene. But then often there is a bit of a dichotomy with what they're trying to communicate with the work and the actual materials that they use in order to do so. So there might be more of an intellectual engagement with how urgent these issues are, but then a bit of a lack of knowledge in actually how you then also practice what you preach. Because actually there's incredible alternatives out there, you know, and still the cultural sector is also very polluting, not only in terms of like its carbon footprint, which is also obviously a big part, you know, and water, waste, energy, mobility, all of that, definitely also very important. But the artist materials is something that we didn't previously speak about so much. Well, as there is, so basically the Future Materials Bank is an online platform, open source. Anyone can contribute with knowledge and take knowledge from it. That is an inventory of materials for artists that are, you know, non-toxic, biodegradable, or otherwise sustainable. And so you can think of glues and polymers, pigments and dyes, eco-synthetics, biomaterials. Yeah, all sorts of alternatives to the toxic materials that maybe you would have. So rather than using a chemical glue, there is glue that's based on fishbone, for instance. Mm-hmm. Or, yeah, obviously lots of different types of mycelia in there. Lots of knowledge on different plants that you can use to make pigments with or dyes. Yeah, it's like it's also an open invitation for people to contribute with their projects, as long as they're not, you know, patented or commercial. So it's really just about knowledge sharing and showing this amazing plethora of materials that is out there that, you know, is better to use, not only for, you know, the planet, but also for your own human health, actually.
Completely. It's so crazy how much pollutants they put into, like, paints and stuff.
Paints, like, I know. Lead. It's so, I know,
paint and I also like to paint, but I've recently just been trying to actually find a more sustainable way of finding the on the Future Materials Bank.
Great.
Find some natural pigments, because they are a lot more expensive. They tend to be a lot more expensive, but if you think about the consequences of it, it's so much more worth it to buy materials that come from natural and sustainable sources.
Yeah, and it's not only the health part, but if you have a look on the website, you also see like it's so beautiful. Colors are so beautiful, and it's also trying to get people excited about, you know, what these alternatives might look like. It's not all about what we can't do, and it all needs to look, you know, all boring or not bright, or but it's actually like amazing materials on there.
Completely, yeah. Some of like the kitchen things I use, like in my kitchen, like beetroot powder, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
An amazing,
so bright,
yeah. So bright. It just makes. I have it in a powder and just a little bit with water, and it's so fun to work with.
Yeah.
And then other things like coffee, or sometimes it's just about being resourceful. But what you can produce from natural pigments, it's like incredible. Yeah. And those, I guess, are the things that have always been used like throughout history to dye our clothes to
No, I think that's also what we try to show. Like, it's not obviously, there's also a lot of new materials on there that are more like material innovations, like a lot of designers are very excited about that. But it's not just new materials, it's also, you know, traditional techniques and indeed using kitchen waste, like, you know, materials made from banana peel and from mussel shells. And so, yeah, it's not just new, it's also reviving other types of knowledge and inviting. I mean, I think also in the pandemic, where it's the peak of the pandemic, people realized like, oh, okay, we have to, we can also just get creative in the kitchen with all, you know, whatever you would have in your in your drawers.
Here, I don't know about where you are, but there was like a yeast shortage, and then everyone making sourdough. And
exactly, yeah. Just, yeah.
It really was lessened, like, in that sense, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But just going back to the book that you're currently writing about the biomimicry of mycelium, can you tell us more about what you're writing about and what you're doing physically with mushrooms as well?
Yeah, of course. So basically what drove me to write this is actually the Alliance that I mentioned. So this Green Art Lab Alliance, which is a group of 50 art organizations that are in Asia, Europe, and Latin America. And it's a support network, and we operate as a knowledge alliance. So without monetary resources, but exchanging all types of other resources. And as, again, as the pandemic kind of peaked, also the interest in the network peaked. And I felt like, so a lot of organizations wanted to join, and I was hesitant about it growing because it, like, possibly diluting, you know, the intimacy and the trust that we have as this group of people. Because sometimes, you know, some groups are also more activist, and of course there's lots of cultural differences. So it needs to be navigated, I think, quite carefully. And so I was looking to identify just like a model for collaboration in which those values could be, you know, kept at the heart of everything. And with the mycelium, I kind of figured that could be the blueprint for this network. So it's really, yeah, I guess at the intersection of art and mycology in that sense. So I'm conducting a lot of interviews with both mycologists and microbiologists, but then also activists and artists and farmers. And what I do is I have 10 different questions, and I have all these different conversations. And the 10 different questions are the 10 different chapters. And so in every chapter, I try to answer that question, but in collaboration with all of these people. So just by what they kind of tell me, it becomes a kind of conversation between all of these people, even though they have never met. And yeah, there's like the questions are related to like, what are the lessons of the mycelium, but also like, what are other types of infrastructure that we can look at, such as, I mean, here in Brazil, there is the MST, for instance, the Movimento de Trabalhadores Sem Terra, the movement of the landless farmers. So how, as a kind of activist group, Do you organize yourself in a decentralized way? But also to do with like protection. So how do you keep safe and how do these support structures look like? Also decision-making processes. There is one example, or just taking lessons from other movements. It's looking partly at the Zapatista Declaration, for instance, you know, the social uprising of the Zapatista group in Mexico, which actually, by uniting these different battles, led to, you know, an actual impact in getting human rights and institutions being formed to support that. So yeah, it's taking also different lessons, not purely from the mycelium, but definitely from groups and movements that I feel already have been working in that, like the mycelium.
So fascinating how in a way it's taking mycelium, and not just mycelium, but finding out how it kind of acts and how successful it is as well in an ecosystem, and how it can be translated into our own kind of connection and collaboration with each other.
Yeah. And how, you know, how things are entangled, and that even it might be on opposite ends of the world, you know, with our, I mean, geopolitical systems and the food distribution across the world, and how our pension funds in Europe are buying land in Brazil that is then again, you know, creating fields for cattle to graze so we can buy that meat again. And, you know, all these entanglements that might seem really far away from each other, but are so directly related to each other. Mm-hmm. So it's about also showing that these entanglements are not about like geographical distance, but there are other types of ties that are invisible, just like, you know, the ties in the mycelium network are to some extent at least invisible. And I think it can also work, of course, a positive way, where when you realize that there's these entanglements, that the exchange could also be mutually beneficial. So that means that if you can do, you know, something positive, it can have an effect on a completely different place in the world.
Completely. And in a way, all these groups and organizations that are popping up are kind of just like fruiting bodies of mycelium.
Yeah, totally. Now, it's also just a really useful metaphor in that sense, that a lot of these different groups, you know, we might use different words to explain what we're trying to do, or we might have, you know, a slightly different focus. You know, the one group is about indigenous rights, or about ocean acidification, or, you know, deforestation. But in the end, there is no single issue environmentalism. All these things are connected to each other.
Yes, it's exactly that, isn't it? That all of these issues are completely interrelated, and
totally,
just focus on one issue and then kind of ignore another, whether it be looking after the forests but not worrying about what's going on in the ocean. And
exactly,
we can't all have our, we can't, you know, take the whole world's issues on our shoulders, but it's just that knowing, isn't it, that there is connectedness that kind of threads us all together. And you're also talking about the language of coloniality and the infrastructure of artist residencies, and I would like you to explain.
So those are also two different chapters. I mean, I think the issue of language is extremely important. Like I just said, like we use also often different words to describe what we do. And some terms, I mean, even to take the example of the word sustainability, you know, it's a word that we use a lot in Europe or Western Europe or United States. And I think even less actually in the United States. But it doesn't resonate in the same way, well, here in Latin America, for instance. You know, it's a term that's associated with Europe, or it's the term that's associated with policy. Even, you know, big car companies, they write sustainability reports. So it's a term that doesn't really travel. And I think understanding that, not just understanding, but in a way celebrating the diversity of languages, and not just like the dominance of the English language, but also how in a lot of different languages, including indigenous languages, actually processes or the natural world are approached in a different way. I mean, in the end, language is like the prism through which we see the world in a positive way, but also the restrictions that comes with. So, you know, using a scientific language to describe whatever plant, yes, it allows us to connect with other scientists, but it also has a lot of limitations. Like an interesting word, I don't even know if I pronounce it correctly, but I read this amazing book that I would also, if you haven't already read it, definitely recommend, called Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. Like in her book, she mentioned this word, which again, I'm probably not pronouncing correctly. That's pupowe in Potawatomi language.
Yeah.
And it's, if I remember correctly, describing just like the force of the mushroom popping out of the ground. And there is no, I don't know any other language, not that I know so many languages, but I can't think of a word in English or in Dutch or Portuguese, you know, that would describe
that. Funny how that. She describes that though, because she was saying it's like the same way bulges can mysteriously appear at night or something.
Yeah.
How she describes it, like things that can just pop up.
Pop up, exactly. Yeah.
Similar force of which mushrooms pop out of the ground.
Yeah. No, exactly. So that's like, but then it's like, yeah, you get, and I mean, even here also on the farm, sometimes, you know, you do your round of harvest and then you water and then, you know, you look up. And then I look back, I was like, oh, did I forget to take this one? Like, I'm sure this wasn't here before.
Wow.
And so it's like, am I going crazy or did that just appear? So there is definitely a mysterious force in the mushroom. Wow. It moves in mysterious ways. I was reading an article actually the other day also about this. I forgot the name of this mushroom now, but it's a mushroom that grows in India. And it only grows when there is thunder and lightning, because like it responds to a certain, I don't know, vibration or electricity. I'm like, what? That's crazy.
Amazing. And I also heard actually that their spores can travel out of our solar system. No, not out of our solar system. Or maybe. I can't remember how far I've read that their spores can travel, but
out of really far. I think that was in Merlin Sheldrake's book. You read something about that. Yeah.
Where I read that. Yeah. And there is something quite spacey about them.
Which I think is also, you know, part of the attraction is the mystery, because, you know, there is a at least for me, there's like a grave for more, you know, the appreciation of magic and mystery and spirituality, and not only valuing the things that are visible or loud, but like renewed appreciation for quietness and
or maybe not the poop away.
But that type of force, you know, an invisible force that's actually not totally influencing the livability, or a lot of invisible forces are influencing the livability on our planet. I mean, CO2, it's an invisible force, or viruses, invisible forces, or winds. I mean, there's so many.
Completely. And it's not everything that we see that we're aware of it, but we don't see it. And
I mean, climate change obviously being the biggest one.
Well, I mean, I feel like I'm feeling it today.
yeah
it's definitely one of those slow creeping forces that might not actually feel like it's happening until,
yeah,
you know.
Well, I mean, in my home country, the Netherlands, like the last few days, it's been massive floodings.
Yeah.
And the city where I used to live, Maastricht, where they have an Ike Academy, is, you know, people were evacuated. In Germany, over 100 people died. And so we're now even reaching the point that it's not invisible anymore. It's not just an invisible force. It's like being pushed in our face.
Maybe in the West it's invisible, but then in other parts of the world I think it's a lot more visible. And that's sad, because it's like developing countries or whatever you want to call them, places where they're not at the top of the rate of giving out CO2 and pollution,
yeah,
are the ones that will first see the effects of climate change.
And just to come back also to actually what your question was, because I think I diverted a little bit from that, about coloniality, because actually a lot of work around climate also has the potential, or a potential trap, of becoming, of reinforcing colonial frameworks. Because it's, I mean, even like the issue of conservation, for instance, like nature conservation, where the approach is often like, okay, this is like an area that we have to protect, so all people out, and we don't touch it, and we rewild it, this and this. Well, as actually here in Brazil, for instance, but in a lot of places in the world, actually the human is also part of being a steward of the forest, or living in the forest. And indigenous communities, I think, are like globally, like, safeguard 85% of biodiversity. So the idea of taking the human out for like protection of nature is a total, well, also kind of colonial idea, in that sense that the human is not part of that.
I've heard some really awful stories about some of the world's top conservation organizations that when they kind of reach to the point where their size, that becomes more like a business, it becomes less about the conservation.
Mm.
And it's quite nasty when you hear from these countries that they're pretending to protect, that actually they're just employed loads of gunmen to surround a forest and let no locals enter, even though they've probably been living off that forest for...
Exactly. It's a completely different idea to what conservation is. And a lot of people have been, you know, dislocated because of that, who were living in the forest, protecting the forest, living with the forest. Mm. And as humans, you know, we are also dispersers of seeds, and we have a role to play in that ecosystem, and we can create also biodiversity. It's not that the human is per se like this bad thing that's only like a destructor of the planet. So yeah, I feel like there's a lot to learn from how different communities are approaching that, or living in that way. And also what I, you know, a much more positive narrative, you know, it's not like, oh shit, we're all bad, and no, we're just ruining everything. It's like, no, we have a beautiful role to play, and that's also a possibility.
That is, yeah, that's so important what you said, because it was also a big thing that Robin Kamama was talking about in Braiding Sweetgrass, is that she's always astounded by people that kind of think, well, we're the bad ones, and not exist on this planet because we're actually, we've always, when we have a good relationship with plants and trees, we know how to use them as medicines, and we develop relationships from respect and not taking as if it was like just an object that didn't mean anything. And in a way it's a really positive message.
Yeah, and she gives a beautiful example also in the book where she speaks about the actual harvesting of the sweetgrass and how the sweetgrass actually flourishes when it's like amongst people, because it means that they're like the new plants or the new sprouts, they actually get a chance to grow, because there is a balance between the new growth and the harvest. And then the reason why it wasn't doing well is because, you know, people weren't living with the sweetgrass. This is such a powerful example, no?
Yeah, I love that. Like the whole thing, that the whole premise of that book was that the sweetgrass is being lost because the culture of raiding sweetgrass was also being...
Exactly,
yeah.
And that's, I think, you know, why also climate and culture are so entangled, and why I think it's so important to also work with artists, designers, makers, all kinds of, you know, creative people, or, you know, cultures, to have this conversation together, because it's not purely a scientific thing. And that's, yeah, of course, science is extremely helpful and extremely important, but I feel like it's really one form of knowledge, and it needs to go, you know, alongside with indigenous knowledge, and it needs to go alongside with cultural approaches. And
completely, it's not just about the raw data and the facts, and
yeah, which is also important, but it's not everything.
Mean much when it's not met with a culture, or
and also in the end, that's not how we make our decisions. We maybe we know, like, oh god, yeah, climate, but I'm still gonna do this and this, because you also make decisions based on, well, that are often very irrational.
More emotively and on feeling.
In
a way, I think that's where the artists come in, because they're able to
find
a concept and then make it so that you kind of feel that heart towards that. So amazing artists doing a lot of activism as well, and then they fight together and
and you can relate to it in a different way, and, you know, reveal that maybe indeed language was in the way, or you can show relationships. And, well, I mean, we've been talking about invisibility, kind of making the invisible visible.
Completely. Oh, wow. Thank you so much for...
Pleasure. It's so nice to talk.
It's been really fascinating hearing about your book, and I'm really excited for when it gets released, because...
Yeah. Yeah, I'm still writing it. No, it will come out spring next year.
Okay, amazing.
Yeah.
And what's it called?
Mycelium as Methodology.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, for people, I guess, to check out the Future Materials Bank and add, you know, their projects, or take knowledge from there if they're interested. Have a look at the Green Art Lab Alliance if they want to. There's a lot of resources and mappings and publications on there too. Yeah, it's all entangled, so we need to connect and share knowledge.
Thank you so much, Yasmin, for joining.
Thank you for having me.
I would also like to just give listeners, any of you who aren't aware of what mycelium is and what it does in our ecology, a brief insight into the world of mycelium. Mycelium is essentially the root structure of mushrooms, which is actually the fruiting body of the root. And this root system is called the mycelium. It's composed of a dense mass of fine, thread-like filaments of tissue called hyphae. The mycelium is an essential part of the support system for the fungus. And these threads naturally extend into the soil, plant matter, wood, and any other materials to pick up water and nutrients and bring them back to the mothership. Can extend and connect multiple plants and different species. They form a hybrid of underground systems called a common mycorrhizal network that runs beneath the forest ground. This network is what allows plants to communicate as they transport sugar supplies to one another when they are needed, or send messages about potential threats from pests, or even supply nutrients to dying trees. But this kind of communication can be found throughout any species of plant or tree living in amongst each other as an ecosystem. Mycelium is what is responsible for breaking down fallen logs or plant matter on the forest floor, or nutrient substrates used to be absorbed through the mycelium wall. These bite-sized nutrients can travel into the fruiting body and can be exchanged for important sugars made via photosynthesis. The mycorrhizal network plays a distribution role to keep the mycelium connected and to keep trees alive and healthy, and the fungi supply of carbon consistent. And as a sort of payment for their services, the mycorrhizal network retains about 30% of the sugar that the connected trees generate through photosynthesis. The sugar fuels the fungi, which in turn collects phosphorus and other mineral nutrients into the mycelium, which are then transferred to and used by trees. These networks are highly intelligent and adaptable. They face challenges, and in order to grow and extend, they find a way to defend against competitors such as pathogens. The mycelium develops enzymes and metabolites that it introduces into the substrate, and these compounds create protection for the mycelium and the entire mushroom. It is in these unique compounds born out of defense against natural environment stresses that increase the medicinal and nutritional value of the whole mushroom. The mycelium acts as the defense mechanism that enables the mushroom to thrive, and the mycelium subsequently supports our immune system when we ingest it as well. So there's so many different types of mushrooms that are edible and contain mycelium that we can use in our own diet for our own health and benefits. But aside from consuming these mushrooms, there are so many benefits that they can give to us and to the planet. For example, they can be used as ways to soak up toxic waste from the earth, to oil spills, and they have an amazing way of even digesting cigarette butts, for example. And there are so many other ways in which they can benefit eco-restoration. Thank you everyone for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Environment and Conservation Show on UK Health Radio. If you like my work, then please feel free to head over to my website, earthwitness.news. You can also check out my Instagram, which is at Yasmin Anta. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you enjoyed. If you wish to be interviewed on the show, if you have a story to share that concerns the natural world, then please do get in touch. We are always looking for more interesting stories and people who are doing fascinating work with the natural world. So goodbye for now, and thanks again for listening.